Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin today's Triangle Business Journal by taking a look at the biz section, which, of course, is a quick glance at Triangle happenings. Here's the article, Feed the World, No Sweat for New Initiative at NCSU. Here at Biz, we like to think we're pretty busy, but a new hire at NC State University has a bigger mission, Feed the Planet. NCSU has its roots in agriculture, and now the school has named Steve Briggs the launch director for the North Carolina Plant Sciences Initiative. Briggs 61 starts August 15th. The big thing is by 2050, we have to produce twice as much food as we are producing today with less land and probably less water, Briggs says, of the global challenge facing agriculture. So how does the world tackle that big goal? To feed a population in 2050 that is much larger than it is today. The goal is to work collaboratively across the school and with industry with the hope NCSU ideas and Wolfpack graduates will harness new technologies and fresh thinking to help ramp up food production. Briggs says his strength is working together with industry, and that will be a key focus as the project unfolds. The effort will break ground on its Centennial Campus Center in 2019 and expects to open in 2021. There's financial muscle behind the project, with a $45 million grant from the Golden Leaf Foundation and $85 million in state bond funding. Briggs came to NCSU after serving as South Dakota wheat growers, but he previously worked in the Triangle at BASF, and he has a daughter who graduated from NCSU. He says his goal is for the school to be the leading research institute in plant sciences and see NC State recognized worldwide. And in other biz news comes the article, Special Ops Troops Get Special Attention. Nearly a dozen Triangle area companies, including Red Hat, SAS, American Underground, Epic Games, and CBRE Raleigh, opened their doors for a special tour on August the 2nd and 3rd by a group of soldiers from U.S. Special Operations looking to transition to civilian life. The mix of Navy SEALs, Marine Rangers, Army Rangers, and Green Berets were all part of a 15-week, 120-hour executive education-style program by the Honor Foundation in Virginia Beach, Virginia, which works with current and former members of U.S. Special Forces units. Our country spends millions every year training these guys for our military. But when they're ready to leave the military, they give them 5 days and they're out, says Stephen Jones, Senior Director of Impact at the Foundation. It has programs in San Diego and Virginia, and Jones says it's also exploring options for North Carolina. The state has a rich variety of military bases, including Fort Bragg and Camp Lejeune. We'd love to expand there, he says. Now, here are a couple of articles under More Jobs on the biz page. Crazy ride continues for the Carey Software Company. Carl Ryden was a young engineer at IBM when Tim Cook worked only 20 yards away. Everybody there knew he was going to be something amazing, Ryden says. He was clearly something else. He was great. Cook is now CEO of Apple, but Ryden isn't doing too badly either. Ryden went on to get multiple graduate degrees at MIT and is now CEO of Precision Lender. The Carey company provides software for banks to help them structure loans, and business is booming. If you have a business and you need a $10 million loan to buy a building, you go to a bank and they use our software to structure that deal, Ryden says. Precision Lender now has 80 full-time employees with more than 60 in Carey and wants to reach 96 by the end of the year. The company now works with more than 200 banks, he says, and continues to add clients. So, more hiring is ahead. He expects to hire 80 more people next year. It's been a crazy ride, he says. The company doubles every year. Even Cook would appreciate that. And now, in the world of ergonomics, is the article, Coming Trend, More Flexible Workstations. If you haven't heard of parity in the workplace, you may in the years ahead, as a trend toward personalization gathers steam. That's the view of Washington-based consultant Ann Tran, who spoke recently at a Cornet corporate real estate seminar in Durham. In Tran's view, offices have been built to certain standards for decades, all desks at one level, for example. But that will change as buildings become smarter and expectations for employees rise. So, for example, she sees a world in which an employee's pass card will be read at any workstation, and the station then conforms to the employee, desk height, computer settings, and so on. And in the age of parity, 6'4" men and 5'3" women could easily find workspaces that adjust to their frames. 5 years is probably the horizon for when we start to see shifts, she says. For real estate developers, Tran believes now is the time to be thinking ahead about how to build structures that can accommodate the technologies ahead. And now from the On Real Estate page, a couple of articles here. First, North Hills Apartments sold for $88 million. A Chicago-based real estate investment firm has paid $88 million for the Park and Market apartment complex at North Hills in Raleigh. The 409-unit building was among the first phases of construction to open on North Hills' east side in 2010. John Kane, chairman and CEO of Kane Realty, says the pricing was a little low by his standards and blamed the seller's unfavorable debt deal that could not be prepaid. County deed records show that the seller, Crow Holdings, had secured the acquisition of the Park and Market property in 2012 with a $57 million loan from State Farm Life Insurance that's payable in May 2021. The loan has since been assumed by the new buyer, Magnolia Capital Group. And on the drawing board, INC Research needs a bigger building. The foundation has been poured, but the developers of the new six-story Perimeter 5 office building in Morrisville have halted most other work at the construction site at the request of the building's anchor tenant, Global Contract Research Organization, INC Research. Revised building plans filed in Morrisville over the summer show that the owners of Perimeter Park are requesting a 23% increase in the size of the Perimeter 5 building, from 214,450 square feet to 263,801 square feet of space, and a structured parking deck that was not included in the previous plans. The extra space is needed, says INC Research's Kevin Brandenburg, Senior Vice President and Head of Corporate Services, to accommodate changes anticipated from the company's recent merger with Boston-based Inventive Health. That deal was finalized August 1st. At this premier location, we'll facilitate increased collaboration and a culture that will enable employees to help biopharmaceutical clients accelerate the delivery of much-needed therapies to patients, Brandenburg says. The headquarters is expected to remain in the Triangle. Jeff Sheehan, a partner at Perimeter Park, co-owner Trinity Capital Advisors of Charlotte, confirms that revised plans have been filed for Perimeter Park, but he would not disclose additional terms of the deal, nor how much the changes would add to the cost of the building. The building is still expected to be ready for occupancy in 2018. County records show that SVT Perimeter 5 LP in February secured a construction loan of up to $36.7 million for the construction of the building. Interestingly, the 12-year lease contract filed in Wake County also has a restriction on the landlord from leasing office space in the future nearby Perimeter 6 and Perimeter 7 buildings to a list of companies that are INC Research's competitors. And now in further real estate news comes the article, Developer Acquires 102 Acres from IBM. IBM has sold a tract of nearly 102 acres of wooded, undeveloped land near its campus in Research Triangle Park, and the new owner of the site is making immediate plans to break ground on the first phase of buildings for a new $60 million industrial park. Rich Horn, president of Indianapolis-based Strategic Capital Partners, says he and his partners have been working for more than a year with IBM and Durham City officials to secure the entitlements needed to construct up to 1 million square feet of new industrial warehouse space, a project they're calling Patriot Park. Phase 1 will include two buildings with a total of 322,800 square feet of space. That's expected to break ground soon, with completion by the second quarter of 2018. There were a lot of issues with this site, Horn says. There were road and site cost issues, infrastructure and utility issues. But the seller gave us time to work through those issues, and we're very excited about it. Within a mile of the Patriot Park site, two more industrial parks are under construction. Over the past 2 years, the two parks have added eight new warehouse buildings with a combined 990,000 square feet of new distribution, storage, and manufacturing space to the region's Research Triangle Park Interstate 40 submarket. Nearly all of the new buildings at Liberty Ridge and TBC Industrial have either sold to new industries coming into the market, like the India-based pharmaceutical firm Lifestar Pharma, or opened fully leased. Power Secure, Peter Millar, and M-Plus are among the major tenants expanding into the new warehouses at Liberty Ridge and TBC Industrial. The vacancy rate for the RTP I-40 submarket's warehouse sector was under 6% in the second quarter, according to Triangle Business Journal's latest quarterly space survey. And moving to the On Technology and Banking page of the latest Triangle Business Journal comes the article, Public Records Show Fight for Infosys. An email chain detailed in 1,346 pages of public records provided by the North Carolina Department of Commerce documents a four-month scramble for a 2,000-job project. While IT firm Infosys announced July 6 they would bring an innovation hub to Wake County, records show it required hustle by state officials to secure the deal. The email flurry started in February with a note from Senator Jay Chowdhury, Democrat of Wake County, to Chris Chung, the CEO of the North Carolina Economic Development Partnership, and Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland, saying Infosys is interested in visiting Wake County as a potential site to add at least 500 jobs. Chung, through Chowdhury, had talked to Infosys officials a month prior to that email for some general background. A meeting would be needed to better strategize, Chung said in his response February 25th. The first visit with Ravi Kumar, President and Deputy Chief Operating Officer at Infosys, was to be March 30th, but had to be postponed. The face-to-face wouldn't happen between Governor Roy Cooper and Kumar until May the 10th, but records show the calls and emails between Infosys and commerce officials continued. Anurag Varma, Vice President of Government Relations, emailed Chung on April the 12th to say the state was on the early shortlist. On May the 15th, Chung learned Infosys wanted a quick call between Kumar and Cooper. I know it's short notice. The added time urgency is due to Ravi's dinner meeting on Thursday with another state that could also be considered for one of Infosys' IT hubs, Chung wrote. On May the 26th, Chowdhury wrote that this time North Carolina is still a strong contender. The only question seems to be whether they will locate to Raleigh and Charlotte, he wrote in an email. But North Carolina had heard similar sentiment before. According to Commerce Department's, Infosys had considered a significant operation in Charlotte of several thousand people back in 2011, but it never happened. Infosys's grant application would later show competition from Texas, Virginia, Connecticut, Maryland, Georgia, Ohio, and Utah. Records would show Atlanta, Dallas, Salt Lake City, and Reston, Virginia had all provided cash grant offers and training grants. And in other news regarding job creation comes the articles that says, officials say North Carolina is ready for the auto plant. The rumor mill started with a tweet. Toyota and Mazda are to build a $1.6 billion plant here in the USA and create 4,000 new American jobs, President Donald Trump tweeted August the 4th. A great investment in American manufacturing. Toyota, by a securities filing, describes the future electric vehicle assembly plant it's partnering on as a 4,000-job electric vehicle plant with a production capacity of 300,000 vehicles, primarily crossover SUVs for Mazda and Corolla sedans for Toyota. No location has been disclosed. But site developers say North Carolina, which has come close to getting past projects from Volvo, Mercedes-Benz, Toyota, BMW, and others, is likely on the radar. Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland won't say whether conversations have happened with Toyota, but he does say North Carolina is ready for a project of its scope. We have the workforce, and now we have several sites that would be appropriate for it, he says. Chris Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, says the state has hundreds of automotive suppliers, such as AW North Carolina, which has more than 2,000 employees making Toyota transmissions in Durham. North Carolina also houses heavy truck manufacturer operations such as Daimler. If an auto assembler were to come to North Carolina, it's likely it would be one of the state's four megasites. 1. Chatham-Siler City Megasite. That has 1,606 acres, including a 1,073-acre megasite and 533-acre feeder park, which is between Greensboro and Raleigh. Secondly, there's the Moncure megasite. That's 2,500 acres, and it's just 45 minutes from Raleigh, 10 miles from NC 540. Third is the Greensboro-Randolph megasite with 1,500 acres in the Piedmont Triad, just 10 miles from I-85. And fourth, it's the Kingsboro CSX Select megasite with 1,449 acres in eastern North Carolina, just 20 minutes from CSX's planned $272 million intermodal terminal in Rocky Mount. Now turning to the On Life Sciences page in this week's TBJ, comes the article, InfoCare Deal Pays Off for Tidewater. Investment firm Tidewater Equity Partners, formerly known as Lookout Capital, and with offices in Wilmington and Raleigh, has seen its first exit through a healthcare deal worth up to $425 million. That deal will see UK-based Mallinckrodt Pharmaceuticals pay $80 million up front and up to $345 million in milestone payments for Pennsylvania-based pharmaceutical company InfoCare, which is expecting U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval for its neonatal treatment for severe jaundice next year. I feel like it's a pretty good exit, so it certainly gives our investors confidence that we can give them access to good deals and good investment returns, says W. Merritt Moore, founder and managing partner of Tidewater. We initially invested in InfoCare through Lookout in mid-2014, and then we've subsequently had some Tidewater investors participate as well, he says, adding that between the two organizations, the investment in InfoCare has been well into seven figures. According to Moore, there's a positive return up front. We made our money back and a lot more, he says. And in total, if milestones are met, it could be 10 times the money invested. Moore credits the North Carolina Biotechnology Center for connecting Lookout and Tidewater with InfoCare. Drug development opportunities can be very risky, says Moore. We've tried to find drug development deals where as much of the risk is mitigated as possible. We liked InfoCare a lot because they were relatively late into their trials and had completed their Phase 2B by the time we came in. He says Tidewater, founded in 2016, is actively looking for more details, for more deals in the healthcare space. These could include late-stage venture deals, as well as buyout or controlling interest deals, he says. And on the life sciences front comes the article, Blue Cross lands near-perfect package in Conway as its next CEO. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina announced on August the 8th that its Board of Trustees selected Dr. Patrick Conway as its new president and CEO. Conway will succeed Brad Wilson, who announced his planned retirement earlier this year. He currently serves as the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Deputy Administration for Innovation and Quality and Director of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. BCBSNC said Conway will join the company October the 1st as president and CEO-elect, with Wilson staying on as CEO for a period of time aimed at achieving a successful transition. Blue Cross North Carolina's role in transforming the healthcare system in North Carolina is a model that other plans aspire to, and that I want to work with the Blue Cross North Carolina team to further improve, Conway said in a statement. I look forward to collaborating with Blue Cross North Carolina employees, healthcare providers, and employers to deliver the best health outcomes and best service experience at the lowest cost for our customers. BCBSNC is the only insurer that offered ACA plans in all North Carolina counties for 2017, and the company intends to serve all 100 counties in 2018 as well. I think he's a near-perfect package. I'm really proud that Blue Cross Blue Shield was able to recruit him, says William Atkinson, former president and CEO of WakeMed Health and Hospitals, adding that he views the appointment of Conway as a benefit to the state of North Carolina. Conway will be facing the same challenges that exist across the country when it comes to uncertainties in terms of health care and the ACA, Atkinson says, and particularly continuously rising costs. And in some legal news for the Life Sciences page comes the article, New Pointer Spruill Leader Wants to Add Young Talent. Pointer Spruill has a new managing partner. Raleigh-based commercial litigator Daniel Cahill has succeeded Joseph Bo Dempster Jr. as the firm's leader. Dempster, who held the position for the last 12 years, is returning to his practice at the firm full-time. I felt the firm was well-positioned for a transition. I'm delighted my partners chose Dan as our new managing partner, and know he will do an excellent job, Dempster said in an email. I'm also looking forward to devoting more time to my practice and to helping the firm develop new clients and build upon our many existing client relationships. Cahill will continue to practice while serving as the firm's managing partner, but says his primary focus will be the day-to-day management of the firm. Another focus, he said, will be adding younger talent to the firm's roster. The firm is currently readying for the arrival of 6 new early career lawyers, including 4 first years, he says. It's very healthy to build in that way, he says, and to retain young, talented lawyers. Pointer Spruill has also added 2 new seats to its management committee to support succession planning at the firm. The firm amended the partnership agreement to include 2 seats open to the partners under the age of 50, says Cahill. Any equity partner in the firm under that age can run for the 2 seats, which have 3-year terms. Those seats, filled initially by Raleigh-based partners Chad Essick and Mike Slipsky, are aimed at bringing in younger voices and different ideas in making critical decisions for the firm, he says. Aside from the new seats on the management committee, Cahill says, Pointer Spruill is also committed to succession planning in other ways. Cahill says he wants a seamless transition when an attorney retires so that clients continue to have a smooth relationship with the firm. That form of succession planning is something many firms are taking a close look at as older partners with hefty books of business hang tight to their clients right up until retirement. And on the acquisitions front, P&A snags Pennsylvania Data Company in major deal. Raleigh-based contract research organization PRA Health Sciences said on August the 7th it had agreed to acquire Pennsylvania-based data and analytics company Symphony Health for $530 million or more, depending on the target meeting certain financial milestones. PRA's play for Symphony Health is the company's first notable purchase since Research Pharmaceutical Services in 2013, said William Blair, analyst John Kruger, in a research note. Symphony is a leading provider of integrated health data and analytics. It's generally viewed as the closest competitor to IMS Health, which combined with Quintiles last year. Thus, we know this deal as another strong vote that data and analytics are becoming clinical tools to improve clinical trial efficiency. On the company's earnings call August 8th, CEO Colin Shannon said the company also completed a significantly smaller acquisition of San Diego-based Parallel 6 in the second quarter. And in the education front, on today's Life Sciences page, comes the article, Resignation of North Carolina Community College Leader Remains Unexplained. Following the unexplained resignation of its current president, James Williamson, on July 31st, after only about a year in the position, the North Carolina Community College System has declined to provide information on a reason for the departure, but says it's focusing efforts on the state's workforce pipeline. Citing North Carolina General Assembly statutes that stipulate the privacy of information in state employee personnel files, spokeswoman for the North Carolina Community College System, Cretha Alston, said, circumstances surrounding Dr. Williamson's resignation is not public information. She said the system is engaged in a strategic planning process designed to meet the state's workforce needs. Scott Shook, chair of the State Board of Community Colleges, declined to comment on Williamson's resignation, which is effective September the 30th, and Williamson did not return a request for comment. Prior to joining the system as president, Williamson served as president and CEO of the South Carolina Technical College System. The two system presidents who preceded Williamson, Martin Lancaster and Scott Rails, served in the position from 1997 to 2008 and 2008 to 2015, respectively. Now moving on to news from around the state, we find this in retailing. CEO says Tanger Outlets is slowing pace and shortening leases. Greensboro-based outlet operator Tanger Factory Centers appears to be erring on the side of caution in light of retail trends, both slowing its opening of new centers and hedging a bit on lease terms. On a recent conference call following release of its six-month earnings figures, Tanger Factory Outlet Center's CEO Stephen Tanger said there were benefits both to Tanger and to its tenants as the REIT had shortened 29 renewals, or 11% of its renewals, to only 12 months. Vacancies are a cancer on any retail shopping center, Tanger said. It's our desire to keep the space occupied. And it's also our desire to control space when the market changes and becomes more robust, which we think it will at some point in the future. We're also finding that the outlets continue to be a very profitable distribution channel for our tenants. Most of our tenants have been in this property for 5, 10, and 15 years, and their stores are fully depreciated. The company is also slowing its development pace. Tanger said the REIT would not open any new outlets in 2018. Tanger Factory Outlet Centers reported net income of 31 cents per common share, or $29.1 million for the second quarter of 2017. For the 6 months ended June 30th, net income was 54 cents per common share, or $51.1 million. The figures for the same periods in 2016 were 76 cents and $1.05, respectively. And in travel, price of rooms shoots up with the PGA in Charlotte. With the PGA Championship in full swing, tourism dollars will be flowing into the Queen City through August 13th. The professional golf tournament, Charlotte's first major, is expected to generate an estimated $100 million from visitors spending money on food, lodging, and other services in the area, according to the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority. The sold-out event is already providing a boon to Charlotte's Airbnb hosts, who are slated to earn a combined $550,000 by sharing their homes with tournament guests, says the home rental platform. More than 1,600 guest arrivals are booked in Charlotte during the time span, up about 55% from the same period in the previous week. The typical listing already booked for the PGA Championship was priced at $90, with most travelers coming from New York City, Atlanta, Dallas, Nashville, Columbia, South Carolina, and Raleigh, according to Airbnb. Only 22% of Airbnb listings in the Charlotte region are available from Thursday through Sunday. Of those remaining listings, the average price per night has spiked to $224. Hotel revenue also will jump. Preliminary figures released August 4th by the CRVA show that hotel demand has increased 54.1% in Uptown and 46.1% across Mecklenburg County this week over the same period in 2016. Room rates are tracking 39.2% higher in Uptown and 42.1% higher in the county. And finally, from the Around the State page on investing. Triad startups get help with the new Angel Network. A new Angel Investment Network, Venture South Piedmont, is launching in the Triad. Venture South Piedmont plans to invest in early-stage companies that are seeking investments of $250,000 to $1 million to expand. The group plans to make its first investments in startups this fall. The creation of a new Angel group comes as startups in the area are having difficulty finding local funding sources, and some in the investment community are looking to fill the void. Piedmont Angel Network, which has been one of the main funding sources in the area, recently said it's looking to raise another fund. That's despite the recent departure of its fund executive. Venture South Piedmont is a branch of Venture South, an angel network that started in Greenville, South Carolina, and has expanded into other markets, including Charlotte and Asheville. The group invested more than $4 million in startups in the Southeast in 2016. Now we turn to the A Better World page. And the article is, Durham Club Supports Local Nonprofits. Exchange Family Center, formed 25 years ago by members of exchange clubs in the region to help prevent child abuse, received $15,000 in the fiscal year that ended June 30th from the Exchange Club of Greater Durham. Through its Durham Bulls and Brew Festival and a beer concession, its volunteer staff at Durham Bulls Athletic Park, the club raises about $30,000 per year to support the Family Center and other local causes. The premise of Exchange is to promote Americanism and community service, to do good in our community, says Debbie Mangum, president of the all-volunteer civic group and co-owner of Mangum Benton Ventures. Since it was formed in 1981, the club has contributed roughly $700,000 to community groups, including a total of $83,000 in the past 3 years, when half the funds each year have gone to Exchange Family Center and half to another 10 to 12 groups that each receive a grant of $500 to $1,000. Operating with an annual budget it generates from $150 dues each member pays each quarter, the club meets for lunch the first four Thursdays of each month from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. at the University Club in University Tower. Three of those meetings each feature a speaker from a local nonprofit or local expert to talk about a community issue, with the fourth meeting focusing on club business. Each quarter, it also hosts an after-hour social event at various locations for members and their families. The club awards funds to nonprofits once per year based on recommendations and then a vote by members. A nonprofit is eligible for funding if a representative of the organization has been a speaker at a weekly lunch meeting of the club within the previous 2 years, or if a club member has a strong relationship with the nonprofit, such as volunteering or making a donation or receiving services. In addition to making contributions, the club also provides a range of programs, typically once per year for each program. To promote Americanism, for example, it works with all the teachers, typically on three grade levels, at a local elementary school. The teachers assign essays on the American flag, and a club committee selects a winner from each grade level. Then, at a school assembly, an ROTC drill team from a local high school performs. U.S. Representative David Price, Democrat from North Carolina, typically presents the school with an American flag that has flown atop the U.S. Capitol. Students read their winning essays and receive a gift of $25 to $50 each, and each student receives a small American flag. Other club activities range from promoting fire safety and crime prevention to recognizing a student of the month and shopping for Christmas presents for children served by a local organization the club selects. We're all very different, Mangum says of club members. Our ages are from the mid-20s to the mid-70s. We're like-minded, but we're very different. I've met people in our club that I would never have met on the street otherwise. And in some nonprofit news from the Better World page, North Hills Sur La Table Leeds Habitat Fundraising. You'll have to forgive my French pronunciation. Congratulations to Sur La Table in North Hills, which led a company-wide effort to support Habitat for Humanity called Home is the Key. The North Hills store raised $3,400 by asking customers to donate at the register. Because that was the most in the national effort, store manager Tricia Tudor, assistant store manager Andrew Klutz, and resident chef Teresa Fox presented an honorary check to Nancy Bromall of Habitat for Humanity of Wake County. A portion of the money raised will be donated locally. Also in nonprofit news, giving housing a hand up. Alliance Behavioral Health Care has provided $250,000 in financing to CASA, a local nonprofit developer. The financing will support the acquisition of 44 units at Underwood Apartments on Underwood Avenue and the 35-unit Maple Apartments on West Chapel Hill Road in Durham. The apartments will primarily target people earning 50% of the area median income or less, which is $25,700 for one person. Leases for current tenants will be honored. And lastly, in nonprofit news, filling the bus. The Kroger grocery chain will partner with the Durham Area Transit Authority to fill the bus with food on August the 12th. The drive will be from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. at the Kroger at 3457 Hillsborough Road in Durham. Donations will go to the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina. And now from the Executive Voice page, an interview with Stephen Kutzer. Stephen Kutzer, President and CEO of Wilmington-based Custom Development and Manufacturing Organization, called a CDMO, Alchemy, is staying busy lately as he leads the company's move of a planned headquarters expansion from Wilmington to the Triangle. Alchemy rebranded to its current name last year after the 2013 merger of AAI Pharma Services and Cambridge Major Laboratories. The CDMO currently employs about 50 people at an existing location in Durham, about 450 in Wilmington, and more than 1,000 company-wide. The new emphasis in the Triangle is expected to create between 100 and 150 jobs locally. Alchemy is a portfolio company of private equity firm Ares Capital. According to Kutzer, Alchemy has annual revenues of upwards of $250 million and has historically seen double-digit growth. So here are five or six questions and answers. First, what motivated your decision to build a career in the pharmaceuticals industry? And his answer, very early in my career, I had the opportunity to work with a team of extraordinary people across various pharmaceutical companies on the successful launch of life-saving innovative drugs. I witnessed firsthand the life-extending success of these drugs and their positive impact on patients and their families. Nothing is more satisfying than having the privilege to be able to help people in their daily fight against diseases. So how did you decide to join Alchemy, and how has the company changed since you were appointed CEO? 90% of new drug development happens in universities, virtual, small, and mid-sized pharmaceutical companies, with that product's drug development team consisting of a handful of innovators and a patent. These innovators are looking for innovative integrated development and manufacturing solutions to transform their ideas into successful drugs that cure diseases. We transformed Alchemy over the last 3 years into a fully integrated custom development and manufacturing organization focusing on the clinical trial needs of the pharmaceutical industry. Alchemy provides active ingredients development and manufacturing, formulation, drug product manufacturing, packaging, release testing, and regulatory support services, focusing on the safest and fastest pathway to a successful product launch. So from a business strategy perspective, why did Alchemy decide to move its planned headquarters expansion from Wilmington to Durham? Our Wilmington operation is an instrumental part of our service offering. Over the last 3 years, we have invested heavily in new laboratory and manufacturing capacities, and the site enjoys an excellent reputation with the regulatory authorities and our clients. As we continue to grow and expand into new technology platforms, for example, HPAPI, which is highly potent active pharmaceutical ingredients, controlled substances and biologics, we learned that this expansion has to happen in a pharmaceutical hub. We need better access to our customers. We need access to a scientific talent pool. We need access to the infrastructure of a larger city, and our customers and investors need easier access to us. So what are some of the ways that Alchemy differentiates itself from others? While other CDMOs are focusing more on commercial supply manufacturing, Alchemy is strongly focusing on the clinical trial needs of our clients. We provide innovative technical solutions to help our clients find a successful scientific pathway for their drugs. Therefore, 75% of our business is coming from products that are currently in the clinic. Alchemy's core technical competencies are in solid-state chemistry, route selection, analytical development, formulation development, regulatory strategy, innovative manufacturing and packaging solutions, and integrated program management. Once a product is launched, we usually provide the early commercial supply before, inevitably, the product is transferred to another manufacturing facility that has large commercial capacity, or locations in tax-incentivized locations. So what are some of the opportunities and challenges you see for Alchemy and the industry as a whole moving forward? The pharmaceutical industry, including Alchemy, is seeing macro trends like increasing average lifespan, global healthcare expansion, talent globalization, and accessibility and an increase in new breakthrough fast-track drugs. While an industry continues to enjoy a very positive outlook, we are currently facing discussions about budget cuts, political instability, such as Brexit, and lower R&D spending in 2017, while we also have to deal with an increase in eradicated disease outbreaks. The pharmaceutical industry plays a very important role in the fight against diseases and the building of a healthier future for all of us, and Alchemy is proud to be part of it. For the remainder of 2017 and moving into early next year, what are the main strategic objectives you're hoping to accomplish? Alchemy is currently preparing for a record 5 new product launches across multiple clients in the second quarter of 2017 and early 2018. We are very excited about these opportunities, and the flawless execution of the launches is obviously our key objectives. And finally, what's your favorite hobby? Watching my 16-year-old son play baseball. He's a pitcher, obviously eyeing to get on a college team. Watching the kids play ball is, for me, like relaxation therapy. And now we reach the small business page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the article is Overlooking a Succession Plan Puts Businesses at Risk. Let me introduce three friends of mine, Jack, Mildred, and Tom. Each one's a senior owner of a successful business, and each one has something to say about planning for business continuity under family ownership and management. First, here's Jack. I've run this company for almost 30 years. I can sure as heck figure out how to keep it going with one of my kids in charge. I've already told the lawyer to draw up some papers to hand over the president's job to my son, John Jr. Something simple, like he texts a pledge of allegiance to me and the business. Hey, Jack, isn't John Jr. an attorney? Yeah, that's what he does now. But I'm going to set him up such a sweet deal for him that, what's the godfather say, he can't refuse it. Money, car, all that. And besides, I'll be there behind the scenes to make the tough calls. Now there's a succession plan. What about the longer-term future, Jack, and the rest of your family's interest in the business? How do you know John Jr. is right for the job? And how long will he put up with having a title but no authority? Look, this is going to work because I say so. That's how I've always run my business, and that's how I'm handling the succession thing. What could go wrong? Got your pencil? I'll give you a list. Now, here's Mildred. I know. Make a succession plan. I wish I had a dollar for every time someone, my lawyer, some conference speaker, even my own daughters, had said, make a succession plan. But let me tell you something. I've seen other families go through that succession planning stuff, and I don't want any part of it. But Mildred, I thought you wanted to keep your business in the family, wanted your two daughters to take over when you're ready to retire. Sure, but I don't need all that heartache of deciding who's number one and who's number two. I don't want to argue about doing things differently when the business has been doing just fine as it is. Who's going to own the stock? Who's going to get dividends if he's not working in the company? All that. No thanks. I'll just walk out the door one day and the girls will walk in. I'll take my chances. You sure will. Finally, listen to Tom. This is a successful business. And one of the pleasures of running it has been having my wife working with me when we started, and the kids joining in several years ago. Although we have our ups and downs, being in a family business is really satisfying. But nothing I've done has prepared me for the complex process of transferring the business to my children. Come on, Tom. You're an effective manager and business leader, and a thoughtful, caring father. What else do you need? Well, one of the things I've learned as a businessman and a parent is that nothing is as simple as it seems. If I can take a thorough and systematic look at what makes this company tick and what it needs in the future, I'll have a pretty good idea of how, when, and to whom to pass along the responsibility and authority for leading it. And then? then I'll get all the help I need to lay out a sequence of actions and events, a real strategic plan for change. That'll produce a smooth transition to the next generation and bright prospects for the company and the family. And then I can retire with real confidence that everything and everyone, including my wife and me, are in good shape. Our friend Jack says he'll just put something together and then tell the family how it's going to be. Listen, I play golf with Jack, and he's a good buddy, Tom says. But let me tell you how he keeps score. And now from the viewpoint page of today's Triangle Business Journal come a couple of articles, one on health. The first one's written by Gary Reedy, who is CEO of the American Cancer Society. And it's entitled, Southeastern States Slow to Adapt Strong Policies to Curb Tobacco Use. As Chief Executive Officer of the American Cancer Society and our advocacy affiliate, the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, also called ACSCAN, I've learned one public health truth that stands out among all others. A comprehensive and effective cancer control plan for any state must start with implementing strong tobacco control policies. A new report published by ACSCAN demonstrates, however, that the legislatures in 12 southeastern states are contributing to an increased cancer burden in this part of the country by failing to implement evidence-based policies to reduce and prevent tobacco use. The result of this inaction has led to some of the highest tobacco use rates in the United States and contributed to cancer death rates that are significantly above the national average. The report shows that Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, and West Virginia have failed to earn a single green rating in the three critical tobacco control measures. That's increasing the price of tobacco through tax increases, implementing comprehensive state smoke-free policies, and thirdly, implementing statewide tobacco prevention and cessation programs. Tobacco use is responsible for more than 480,000 premature deaths annually in this country, and one-third of all cancer deaths. In fact, tobacco is linked to a dozen different types of cancer. Based on data from the National Vital Statistics System from 2010 to 2014, the lung cancer mortality rate in the 12 southeastern states combined is about 20% higher than in the rest of the country. For patients and their families, the costs associated with direct cancer care are staggering. In 2014, U.S. cancer patients paid nearly $4 billion out of pocket for cancer treatments. Cancer also represents a significant proportion of total U.S. health care spending. Roughly $87.8 billion was spent in 2014 in the U.S. on cancer-related health care. Clearly, there is both a moral and economic imperative to reducing the cancer burden. According to the U.S. Surgeon General, cigarettes are more addictive and deadly than ever before. It's time to finish what we started more than 50 years ago, when the Surgeon General first announced the link between cigarettes and deadly diseases such as cancer. As the CEO of the American Cancer Society, I strongly encourage members of the business community to support good health through strong tobacco control policies that are proven to reduce cancer incidence and death so we can all prosper and thrive. Now the second article from today's Viewpoint page comes from Lynn Good. Lynn Good is chairman and CEO and president of Charlotte-based Duke Energy. Her column is entitled, Energy Grid Still Lags Behind. As a native of Ohio, home of the Wright brothers, and now a resident of North Carolina, where their dream literally took off, I have a special fondness for the inventors of modern flight. I sometimes wonder what Orville and Wilbur would think if they saw a Boeing 747 roar ahead. Would they even recognize what they had started? For that matter, Alexander Graham Bell would literally look at a touchscreen smartphone and ask, "What's this?" But what about Thomas Edison? He might look up at a power line mounted on a wooden pole and say, "Yes, that's how I left it." Today's energy system is in some ways light years from what Edison gave us. I doubt he anticipated splitting atoms to make electricity. But in some respects, the grid is very similar to what it was more than a century ago. To be fair, that system has worked incredibly well to provide America with a gold standard of power generation, transmission, and delivery. Still, at the most fundamental level, the grid operates primarily as a one-way road, sending electricity from centralized power plants to customers. The good news for our customers is that our industry is working furiously to modernize it, to make it smarter, greener, and more capable than ever. The grid needs to work more like a multi-lane freeway, sending energy and information in both directions with more on and off ramps. It needs to provide greater flexibility, even better reliability, and more product and service options for homes and businesses. This modernization is underway and will provide our customers with a much better experience. Some of the changes will be noticeable, like mobile apps that provide customers the information they need to control their energy usage and save money, or self-healing technologies and grid hardening techniques that make power outages shorter and increasingly rare. And some changes will be less noticeable to the eye, but no less important. This includes the ability to smoothly integrate greater levels of renewable energy and emerging technologies like battery storage onto the system, enabling a cleaner and more reliable generation mix. Modernizing the grid in this way requires a higher level of investment than we've seen before. Last year alone, the industry spent about $53 billion on the energy grid. That's up 10% from the previous year. This effort, which will go on for years, will create new jobs and serve as an economic stimulus for local communities. It's the same for Duke Energy. We operate the largest energy grid in the country, with more than 300,000 miles of transmission and distribution lines serving 25 million people. To modernize that system, we plan to invest $25 billion over the next decade to build a smarter energy future. In North Carolina alone, this ambitious program will create nearly 14,000 jobs and more than $1 billion in tax revenue for local communities. This will open the floodgates for limitless innovation by energy companies, as well as mobile technology developers, application engineers, and entrepreneurs. This is all while ensuring that we are able to continue delivering the reliable, affordable, and increasingly clean power customers demand. I like to think that if Edison could see today's energy grid, he would be humbled by the spectacular advancements that affordable, reliable, and safe electricity has made in our lives. But he would be even more excited about how we are transforming the grid to serve the next generation. And finally, one other little item from the viewpoint page of today's Triangle Business Journal is a survey, the ACBJ Business Survey Pulse. And the question posed was, how much importance does your company give to cybersecurity? Now, there isn't any writing here, it's just a graph. And so here's the data as a result of 460 responses. 66% says it's very high importance, while only 14% say it's moderate importance. 12% say it's the most important thing in our company. 7% say low importance. That's not very encouraging. And 1% says no importance at all. Once again, this is a result of 460 responses. And if you want, the Triangle Business Journal invites people to go take our survey. It says go to trianglebusinessjournal.com/pulse to take other surveys on the page. Now for a few tidbits from the People on the Move page today. The spotlight is on Pete Williams, who is SVP and Chief Credit Officer at M&F Bank. Pete Williams, who has spent decades with some of North Carolina's largest banks, was tapped as Senior Vice President and Chief Credit Officer of Durham-based M&F Bank. The 110-year-old bank will use Williams' experience to oversee the credit functions of the institution. He spent the last 13 years as a senior manager at Credit Risk Management, and prior to that, served as a regional executive vice president at First Citizens Bank. Headquartered in Durham, M&F Bank has 0.37% Triangle deposit market share at $149.3 million, according to the latest statistics from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So here's a question. What's a goal you have in this new position? And Williams' answer, M&F is in an excellent position to acquire new clients, William said. A lot of people don't know about M&F Bank, but we have a lot to offer, especially to clients who may have been in other community banks that have been acquired by much larger banks. His education? A bachelor's degree in business administration from NC&T State University and a graduate of the North Carolina School of Banking in Chapel Hill. And here's some other people in the news. Let's see, from the construction sector, there's Christy Stewart. Atlantic Corporate Contracting hired Christy Stewart as operations coordinator. Also in the banking department is Stephanie Brown. Fidelity Bank hired Stephanie Brown as assistant vice president and branch manager of its Wake Forest branch. In health, Gene Kurtzer. Gene Kurtzer was named president and chief operating officer of Affordable Dentures and Implants, dental support organization Affordable Care. In real estate, a couple of folks here, there's Kathy Powell, who was named president of the Building Owners and Managers Association of Raleigh-Durham. And also Jonathan Paolo and Betsy Persak. Coldwell banker Howard Perry and Walstern hired Jonathan DePaolo as a sales associate in its Fuquay Arena offices, and Betsy Persak was hired as an online marketing specialist at the Jim Allen Group at CBHPW. Finally, in consulting, there's Richard Carden, Rachel Eigen, and Johnny Hawley. Paragon Safety Group hired Richard Carden as a field safety consultant. Richard Eigen was hired, and Johnny Hawley was promoted to field services manager at the company. Also in construction is Brian Ardner. Ardner was hired as vice president of pre-construction at Kaufman Lynn Construction. Tom Plant joined Choate Construction as division manager of its Raleigh office. And finally in construction this week is William Sutphin. William Sutphin was hired as Raleigh Division Manager at HHH Homes. Well, I see that we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. Once again, that's 919-832-5138.